Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, from Birth of a Nation to the horror film Get Out, Hollywood's unfinished journey from racism to reconciliation, the invasion of Sicily in 1943 and the lessons that were learned for D-Day, how Winston Churchill used newspapers to develop his image, the Irishman who led the Ulster Division in the First World War, and we'll end the show by investigating the 7th century law that offered legislative protection for women, children and other civilians in times of war. Last week we debated the Battle of Stalingrad and we found out how it helped change the course of the Second World War. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin tonight's show with Hollywood's unfinished journey from racism to reconciliation. From the beginning, American cinema has been both a powerful mythmaker and a social critic, and a new book explores the racist history of America's national art form, as well as the subject of race and reconciliation. It's called A Long, Long Way, Hollywood's Unfinished Journey from Racism to Reconciliation. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs $18.99 sterling, so about €21. The author is Greg Garrett, and Greg, you're very welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Patrick.
Can we begin with D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation? Because it's considered one of those great early movies. It was the first film ever shown in the White House in 1915. Is extraordinarily racist. And I suppose it's a movie that sums up some of the issues and themes you're exploring in this book.
Yes, we absolutely have to start with Birth of a Nation, which is such an important film in certainly in American film and cultural history. It was released in 1915, and as you mentioned, it was incredibly important as an early feature film, shown at the White House, widely reviewed, incredibly popular. And the thing that's really important about it is that it's a great work of art, as well as being a work of sort of heinous racist ideology. The great American writer James Baldwin talked about how it was an artistic masterpiece and an incitement to genocide. And both of those things have to be held in our mind at the same time, because it wouldn't be such an important film and it wouldn't have influenced race in America so much if it hadn't been such a powerful movie-going experience.
And you also look at movies all the way up to the present day. And one of the films that you talk about is Get Out, which is ostensibly, a horror film, but also has a lot to say about race and racism in American society.
Yeah, the book looks at basically 100 years of American film history and at tiny steps forward in Hollywood and in the culture. And Get Out represents the last phase that I talk about, which is where people of color are not only making their own movies and writing their own stories, but they're using traditional Hollywood genres like the horror film as a way of pushing back against injustice. And it's a lovely way to sort of come full circle, because if, as James Baldwin is right, we see Birth of a Nation using all of these Hollywood tropes and genres as a way of reinforcing racism, what Jordan Peele does in Get Out is he pushes back against all of that 100 years of film history. And I also really loved ending with Get Out, because one of the themes that I come back to over and over, starting with Birth of a Nation and talking about midway through the book with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, is that one of the racial issues that Hollywood wrestles with, just as the West has wrestled with, is interracial marriage. And so Get Out is a sort of horror remake of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, about a white woman bringing her black boyfriend home to meet her family. And so there's this wonderful sort of sense of echoes throughout American film history that Get Out is turning on its head as well.
And you also get a great sense of what America was like at the time, because I'm sure if Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was being made now, it would be done in a very different way, even recognizing the changes in society. But because it was new then, you had Spencer Tracy, you had Catherine Hepburn, Sidney Poitier, it was done in a very distinctive way and kind of reflective of the era in which it was made.
No, that's absolutely right. And for a show like this, it is so lovely to talk about how it reflects history. When the movie was being produced, interracial marriage was illegal in one third of the American states. And so one of the things that I think is always important, and I talk about this in the book and whenever I screen the film, is that although to us in 2020, it doesn't seem like such a radical film, at the time of its making, it was incredibly radical. It was pushing the progressive agenda in terms of race in a very powerful way. And to have Sidney Poitier kiss his white girlfriend on screen was a sort of monumental thing in 1967. And so it's always important for us when we talk about received texts to think about the world into which those texts emerged and to think about the history that they reveal to us. And that's one of the things that I also try and do with each of the films in the book.
Do you think our culture has changed over that period, if you look, that 100 years? You know, have we actually come a long, long way, as the title suggests?
Well, the title actually operates in a positive and negative way in terms of response to that. And early in the book, I mentioned that the title comes from something that Dr. Martin Luther King used to say when he was asked about the state of race relationships. He said, "We have come a long, long way, and we have a long, long way to go." And so that's the painful reality, is that we can look at a film like Birth of a Nation and say to ourselves, well, there's no way that a movie like this could be made in 2020. But as I mentioned early on, when we think about the ways that that film continues to send waves out through American culture, the sentiments and the racial ideologies that are being expressed in Birth of a Nation are the same sorts of things that the white supremacist marchers in Charlottesville, Virginia, were chanting a couple of years ago. There's a direct through line to that early 20th century racism that's still being reflected by white supremacists in America today. And so I think that's the only possible answer, is to say, yes, in terms of the culture, in terms of racism, we have made great strides, and we can make a movie like Get Out. But we also have movies like Do the Right Thing, which is 31 years old this year, and it is still incredibly current. Black men are still being killed by police officers on the streets of America. It is a film that I wish weren't as powerfully current as it continues to be.
And I suppose that brings us to the second dimension of the study, which is that unfinished journey to reconciliation. And what steps do you think still need to be taken?
One of the reasons that I wanted to write this book is because I felt that first film would make it possible for us to have some important conversations about where we were and where we needed to go. But in an even more important way, the historical dimension of these films that we've been talking about offer us, I'm not going to even say the opportunity, I'm going to say the responsibility of taking a look at our American history and acknowledging and, in theological terms, repenting of the harm that we have done as a culture to people of color, to people outside the white mainstream. And so late in the book, I talk about some of the ways that I think that we can make some steps forward, some of the opportunities for us to acknowledge that painful past and to begin hard conversation with the people that have been most affected by it, and then to think about how we might repair those relationships moving forward. And so that's what these movies sort of offer us the opportunity to do. So when we talk about Birth of a Nation, or we talk about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, or we talk about Get Out, we are able not only to have those hard conversations about racism and prejudice, but also to think about how could we move forward and what does a future look like in which we don't have to have these conversations anymore.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. It's called A Long, Long Way, Hollywood's Unfinished Journey from Racism to Reconciliation. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £18.99 sterling, so about €21. The author is Greg Garrett. And Greg, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, such a joy. Thank you so much for having me, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. The Allied assault on Sicily on the 10th of July 1943 remains the largest amphibious invasion ever mounted in world history, landing more men in a single day than at any other time. That day, over 160,000 British, American and Canadian troops were dropped from the sky or came ashore, more than on D-Day just under a year later. It was also preceded by an air campaign that marked a new direction and dominance of the skies by the Allies. And a new book tells the story of the biggest seaborne landing in history. The book is called Sicily 43, The First Assault on Fortress Europe. It's published in hardback by Bantam Press and costs £25 sterling, so about 28 euro. The author is James Holland. And James, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Patrick.
Can we talk about the background to it? What was the strategy that was in place here?
Well, you have to remember this is coming on, you know, the invasion is on the night of the 9th, 10th of July, 1943. And the North Africa campaign has basically been going on for the best part of 3 years. And back in May 1943, it finally came to an end when the Allies trounced the Axis forces. Axis forces completely surrendered. So suddenly they're masters, the Allies are masters of the North African shores. And in the process of doing that campaign, which was a predominantly British one, although it was kind of by the end, it was certainly 50-50 in terms of air power between the Americans and the British. You suddenly got this enormous force. You know, you've got huge naval forces, you've got huge land forces, and you've got huge air forces. And they're sitting there, and it's already been agreed that there's going to be no cross-channel invasion of Northwest Europe, of France, in 1943. So what are you going to do till the following May, which is when D-Day, as we know it, the Normandy invasion is due to take place? So there's all sorts of very good reasons for invading Sicily, because that might hasten Italy out of the war. And if Italy's out of the war, then Germany's got a stark choice. It either has to bring its own troops to occupy all those Greek islands and Greece and the Balkans, as well as Italy and Sicily, or it's got to retreat. And either is not good for Germany. And this is all part of the Allied policy of kind of slowly but surely kind of sort of tightening the noose around the Third Reich. So there's very, very good reasons for doing it. And that's why in January 1943, before the North Africa campaign is finally over, the Casablanca conference, the American and British chiefs of staff and Roosevelt, President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Winston Churchill all agree that it would be a good thing to do.
And it's incredible the fighting that took place. And as you show, it was a brutal campaign. And there were also quite cinematic and dramatic moments during the fighting as well, with the raids by the special forces. You see them making deals with the mafia. That there is a cinematic quality to it as well.
Yeah, there is. You know, I suppose the other thing is it's an island, Sicily, although quite a big one. So it's got a very sort of obvious start, middle and end. And it's a battle that involves naval forces and air forces. And as you say, land forces, but also special forces, you know, airborne drops, glider drops, there's paratroopers, there's the SAS or the SRS, the Special Raiding Squadron, as they're briefly known during the Sicilian campaign, led by that legendary Irishman, Paddy Mayne. And there's all sorts of going on. You know, there's Tiger tanks, there's dogfights over the island. There's mad Germans wearing claymores and kilts. There's all sorts of stuff going on. There's German Fallschirmjäger, which is the German name for paratroopers. So they've got their own special forces in play as well. And really, in terms of human drama, it's kind of hard to beat. And overhead is this sort of relentlessly scorching heat of kind of 40 degrees plus, which is sort of baking everybody dry. There's malaria. And as you say, there's the mafia as well. So sort of lurking in the background. And so it's a really, really fantastic story. And it really struck me that it was odd that not more had been made of it. And I suppose, you know, when you look at the Second World War, it tends to be those parts of the Second World War where major successful movies have been made tends to be the ones that people are interested in reading about and learning more about more than others. And, you know, there just haven't been a great movie about Sicily, with the possible exception of the biopic about Patton.
And you mentioned some of the difficulties that the Allied forces had. You had a bad infrastructure. It was difficult making your way through the island. And then, as you say, you have these problems of malaria, dysentery and disease. So death was around every single corner.
Yeah, I mean, Sicily's a brutal place in which to fight. And it's very interesting. I mean, I remember when I went there for the first time, and I remember standing on a hilltop town called Centuripe. And Centuripe is a bizarre-looking town because it's right high on the top of this mountain, and it's sort of spread out. So from the air, it looks like a kind of spread-eagled man. It looks like a man with, you can see his head and two arms and two legs all stretched out. It's a very, very odd place. I remember standing up there and just thinking, blimey, you know, you've got to take this, then you've got to take another hill, then another hill. There's Etna in the northeast of the island, just sort of bearing down on you, kind of sort of following you everywhere you look, a bit like sort of Sauron's Eye or something from Lord of the Rings. An incredible effort. And actually, it was the Irish Brigade that took Centuripe in the end. But it's just a really, really tough place to fight because, as you say, there's not much infrastructure. There's not many tarmac roads, asphalted roads. So, you know, when you're attacking, your enemy can see you all the time. The Germans, you know, they were fewer in number and the Italians were fewer in number, but they always had a huge advantage of being defensive that they could look down from whatever hilltop town they were currently defending, see the Allies coming, because it'd always be a kind of sort of big cloud of dust whenever they advance, and start shelling them. And on top of that, as you say, you've got this sort of appalling malaria. I think kind of more than 50% of the casualties on during the Sicily fighting on both sides were from malaria and illness. You know, a lot of the water is brackish, so, you know, it's not really drinking water. I mean, up on those hilltop towns, I mean, it was really, really feudal. I mean, nothing really much had changed for hundreds of years. And in terms of kind of human effluence and stuff, you just chuck it out in the street. So you can sort of imagine what it was like. I mean, it was just an incredibly tough place in which to fight. And not many roads. And you've got to advance up, you know, say in the case of Centuripe, for example, you've got your axis of advance is basically up one road. And then you've got to go down it the other side. And all the time you're moving, the Germans, the enemy, have got their eyes on you. And they're shelling you and mortaring you and all the rest of it. So it's just a really, you know, tough, attritional slog under a kind of sort of unbelievable blazing heat. And you all know how much heat is conducted by metal. So imagine, you know, you've got to wear your helmet, because if you don't, you know, you're risking yourself. But imagine what it's like putting on a helmet, you know, in 40 degrees heat. It's like putting your head into a kind of furnace. So, you know, small things like that, which kind of don't really bother you in winter or in, you know, Northwest Europe, but absolutely bother you when you're on Sicily.
It was an important victory for the Allies. Did they take lessons from it when they were planning D-Day a year later?
Yeah, no, they absolutely did. I mean, there's a number of really, really important lessons. I suppose the first one is that, you know, all through the planning of Sicily, I think, actually was exceptional. And you said in your introduction that it was the largest amphibious landing. It was in terms of manpower, absolutely wasn't in terms of shipping. You know, that was D-Day, but certainly in terms of the number of men dropped. But just think about what they've got to do. You know, they've got to get invasion forces from northwest Africa, so from Tunisia and Algeria, also from Egypt. You know, Egypt is 900 miles away. You know, it's a good old distance across the whole width of the Mediterranean. They've all got to land at kind of pretty much the same time. And they don't really know what they're going to be, you know, what they're going to be greeted by when they actually do the landing. And this is the big problem, that most of the planning was taking place while the Tunisian campaign was still being played out. And most of the future commanders of the Sicilian campaign were also had their hands full fighting in Tunisia. And one of the big things they took away for D-Day the following year in June 1944 was that your planning teams need to be completely focused from current operations. They need to be separated from that and need to be focused on the job in hand in total, which is why Eisenhower, Montgomery, Patton and others are all moved out to the Mediterranean theater at the very end of 1943 to give them a full kind of, you know, 5-6 months in which to get ready. And I suppose the other big lesson they learn is about airborne operations and the crews that are delivering those airborne troops just need to be better. They need to be better trained. There needs to be better coordination and so on. Because you've got this weird sort of paradox in Sicily that you've got some of the best trained troops in the paratroops, in the airborne troops, being delivered to the combat zone by the least trained and least proficient air crew. That's not always absolutely the rule, but as a kind of rule of thumb, it certainly is the case. And that's something else that they work very, very hard on, particularly the British. Really start to up the ante with their glider pilots and make them much better trained so that, you know, one of the guys you get scattered to the four winds, for example, on Sicily is a chap called Jim Woolwork. you know, he's way, 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 way off where he should be on D-Day night over Sicily. But on D-Day over Normandy the following year, he's the one who lands with utter precision on Pegasus Bridge, you know, captures the bridge and all the rest of it, and the rest is history. So, you know, a lot of lessons are learned, certainly.
Okay, well, congratulations on the book. It's called Sicily 43, The First Assault on Fortress Europe. It's published in hardback by Bantam Press and costs £25, so about €28. The author, James Holland. And James, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Before Winston Churchill made history, he made news. To a great extent, the news made him too. If it was his own efforts that made him a hero, it was the media that made him a celebrity, and it has been considerably responsible for perpetuating his memory and shaping his reputation in the years since his death. And a new book explores Winston Churchill's life in the news. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. It's called Winston Churchill, A Life in the News. The author is Richard Toy. And Richard, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Can we begin by talking about Churchill's journalism? Because it was something that he kept at for a large portion of his career over probably about five decades.
Yes, that's right. So this was kind of the way he started off trying to make his name, really, just after he qualified as an army officer and left Sandhurst. He went to Cuba, which was then in under the control of the Spanish, but not very well under control of the Spanish. There were rebels fighting against them. And Churchill wrote articles for the Daily Graphic describing what he'd seen. And so that was the first of the series of small wars which he reported on up to and including the Boer War. But then, as you say, actually he didn't give up journalism, even at the point where he became an MP. And was sometimes sort of producing journalism even when he was actually a minister. And really his sort of last sort of serious journalism, if you like, of course, he continued to sort of publish, sort of republish articles later. But sort of late 1940s, when he was in opposition, he was actually still occasionally producing major magazine articles on themes such as the Cold War and the question of European unity.
It's fascinating to read about his interest in his own media profile and his own image. And it's interesting that that image itself changed over time because he was viewed very differently in the earlier part of his career.
Oh, yes. I mean, and of course, you know, part of his changing image was to do with his sort of changes in political parties. He, of course, joined the Liberals in 1904, switched back to the Conservatives in the mid-1920s. But there were also physical changes, of course, that from a relatively, you know, sort of svelte young man, he obviously filled out a bit as he went older. He lost much of his hair. But there were also things which were sort of in his control, if you like. He couldn't really control how he looked, but he could control the way he dressed. He could control the accessories that he used, so that you will see that although, of course, we now associate Churchill very much with the cigar, you sort of draw a cigar and say, you know, which political figure are you thinking of? Then most people would instantly say Churchill. But in the Edwardian period and for some years after that, he was actually associated with hats. In particular, cartoonists would draw him, if they wanted to identify him, they would draw him with a very tiny hat. Which he claimed came about during, as a consequence of one of the general elections of 1910, when he said he was going out of a house, picked up a hat that was sitting on the sideboard, and it just happened to be too small. And after that, sort of cartoonists adopted this as the sort of the symbol of Churchill. And he claimed that he wasn't really terribly interested in hats, but you know, actually, I think that he. When he knew there were going to be pressmen looking, he was actually quite concerned to, you know, sort of wear an interesting hat, knowing that this would provoke comment and attention, even if actually he wasn't intrinsically that fascinated by headgear.
He went to great lengths to try and control the media, and he had contacts with journalists that could all often become tense, but he'd also like to try and have these friendly relationships with the powerful press proprietors.
That's right. So, I mean, I think that in general, he saw himself as dealing with the proprietors and the editors rather than normally with individual journalists. And so he kind of, you know, sort of wanted to sort things out on a higher level. But he would ring editors late at night. He would try and influence the coverage in his favor. But also, of course, during World War II, he became very angry frequently at the press coverage that the government was getting, which he saw as unjust, which he saw as likely to be damaging to morale. And famously, there was an episode early in 1942 where the government came quite close to shutting down the Daily Mirror because of what Churchill and indeed other ministers saw as unfair assaults, which were going to be sort of damaging the public's willingness to fight on.
Was there a public Churchill different to the private Churchill, or was that image in public the same as the reality behind the scenes?
Well, that's a good question. I think he was somebody who was quite willing to guard his private life. He did become resentful, particularly during the 1930s and onwards, of the kind of developing paparazzi, the people who would try and take shots of him where he was sort of enjoying himself on holiday and so on. He didn't like this sort of candid photography. On the other hand, he was somebody who did make use of his private life in order to burnish his image. Of course, he had this wonderful house, Chartwell, in Kent, and he was keen to invite journalists around to have a look, to see him undertaking his hobbies, such as building walls, bricklaying. And so he kind of carefully cultivated that. So I think that I wouldn't say there was a wild discrepancy between what he was like in public and what he was like in private. I think he was probably more willing to sort of bang the table and sort of get angry when he knew that that other people were around. But of course, that was to some extent part of his public image as well. So I don't think one could sort of convict him of hypocrisy of being one person in private and another in public. But I think there were he carefully cultivated the image of what he was like in private. And of course, there were things which journalists didn't get to see or know about.
He's sometimes compared to Boris Johnson because of the career in journalism and then the political career as well. But reading the book, I got the sense that in many ways, Winston Churchill was the more sophisticated user of the media, or had a more nuanced relationship or understanding of how media worked than Boris, which is perhaps surprising because it was an earlier age.
Yes, I suppose what I would say of Churchill is he really did write extremely well, and that he, whether or not you agreed with him, certainly his thoughts were well expressed and were kind of worthy of discussion. He wasn't somebody who sort of purely went for cheap lines. I mean, he could be quite erratic in terms of sort of suddenly coming up with ideas, publishing articles, which sort of were a bit of a bombshell. But I don't think that he was somebody who was just doing it for attention. I mean, just thinking for a while about why he did do it. Of course, like Boris Johnson, he did it partly for the money, but also he did it to advance serious political positions and serious ideas. And this was, when he felt, sometimes he was getting more coverage than he would really admit. So he would sort of complain often that his speeches weren't getting enough coverage in the papers, whereas in reality, most speeches that he made got some kind of significant report. But his view, and this really developed during the First World War, was, well, look, I could stand up and make a speech in the House of Commons, which would take me several days to prepare, and then I don't get very much coverage, or I could write an article for a Sunday newspaper for which I get paid several hundred pounds, which of course in those days was a considerable amount of money, and therefore I both get paid and get my views across. So that was kind of a winning combination for him.
Well, that's a fascinating story, and you tell it so well in the book, Richard. It's called Winston Churchill, A Life in the News. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £25 sterling, so about €28. The author, Richard Toy. And Richard, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Oliver Nugent, Ireland's longest-serving divisional commander of the First World War, led the Ulster Division on the Western Front from 1915 to 1918. That period saw the operational transformation of the British Army and his own development as a general, all the way up to the great German Spring Offensive of 1918. And the story has now been told in a brilliant new book, Major General Oliver Nugent, the Irishman who led the Ulster Division in the Great War. It's published in hardback by the Ulster Historical Foundation and costs £19.99. So about €22. The author is Nicholas Perry. And Nick, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Patrick, thanks very much for having me.
Can I begin by asking why Oliver Nugent isn't better known either in Northern Ireland or in the South? Because he did achieve some quite remarkable things and was a major figure in the story of the First World War.
He certainly did. I think he probably falls between two stools, really, because although he is a unionist, or was a unionist living in Ulster, because he came from County Cavan, of course, was something of a no-man's land politically in the period we're talking about, and because he had a difficult relationship with the Ulster Unionist leadership, particularly James Craig, I think he hasn't or didn't get the recognition he deserved in the North, and of course he ended up living in the Irish Free State, where there's a different memory of the war, and his association with the Ulster Division, you know, probably wasn't a high priority for people. But secondly, he's left an archive, one of the most important of any British First World War general. But because it's been in Belfast, you know, in the Public Record Office, and only recently acquired, it's probably little less well known than it ought to be.
He was quite a remarkable commander during the First World War, and he wasn't one of those generals who stayed at the back. He was right there at the fighting and had occasional narrow escapes.
He did, both as a brigade commander in 1915 in the Ypres Salient, he had several narrow escapes, but then as a divisional commander, commanding the Ulster Division from September 1915 onwards, he spent a lot of time in the trenches visiting his troops. And then in major battles, he tended to try and get forward as much as he could to try and find out what was going on. But of course, one of the great difficulties of First World War Command was the poverty of tactical communications. Once troops were launched into action, it was very hard to find out. Generals found it very hard to find out what was going on. So although he went forward, he often couldn't do much to influence events once the attack had begun.
And he had quite a difficult relationship with General Haig. And did that contribute to him being moved to India at the start of 1918?
Yes, it did. He and Douglas Haig were at staff college together in the 1890s, and they didn't get on. And that personal animosity continued into the First World War. Although, actually, in most of their day-to-day dealings, when they came across each other, it seemed sort of courteous enough. There was a real tension between them over the issue of recruitment, Irish recruitment, and how well the Ulster Division was doing in terms of recruitment. And that led to a request by Haig in 1917 that Nugent volunteered to drop the title Ulster in exchange for getting British conscripts to make up their numbers. And Nugent was reluctant to do that. So that worsened their relationship. Haig blocked the award of Nugent's knighthood in 1918, which was a matter of great hurt to Nugent. And then in May 1918, Nugent was replaced by a younger officer and sent off to India.
Can we talk about his relationship with Ulster Unionism? Because during the 1910s, he was a part of this Cavan volunteer force. It didn't want to be, it was different from the Ulster volunteer force. But he did sign the Ulster Covenant. He was a unionist, but he had some problems with the Ulster unionist leadership.
Yes, I mean, he was a unionist, quite a committed unionist before the First World War, but he was essentially an Irish unionist, and part of the story of Nugent and the Ulster Division is there is an Irish unionist officer commanding an Ulster unionist formation, and that does reveal some of the tensions within Irish unionism during the First World War. But he became a involved with the Cavan Volunteers in 1914 at the request of his close friend Lord Farnham, who was the leader of the Cavan Unionists. And that placed him, Nugent, in a difficult position because he was still a serving British officer and leading a paramilitary force, ostensibly at least, ready to fight the British army. It was not a comfortable place to be. And so he went out of his way to stress that the Cavan Volunteers, under his leadership, would be an entirely defensive force and would not confront the police and army. They were there to protect Unionists and Protestants in the event of their being attacked. And he made that quite clear publicly in press interviews. And that was the first kind of public divergence from the mainstream Ulster Unionist position on a number of things. But he thought he looked to the First World War as an opportunity for Irish domestic political divisions to be submerged in a common cause, whereas, of course, many Ulster Unionists were looking at the war as an opportunity to differentiate loyal Ulster from the rest of Ireland.
In the 1920s, he found himself living in the new Irish Free State, and it seems to me to have been a somewhat uncomfortable fit for him.
It was. I mean, he adapted reasonably well to life in the Free State, but he did devote most of his time to commemorating those who died in the war and providing welfare to those who had survived it. That was where his focus was. He didn't get involved in politics. He had hoped that the war experience would have been a unifying factor for people coming back from the war. But, of course, many ex-soldiers fought on both sides, both the War of Independence and subsequently in Northern Ireland. So it didn't have the unifying effect he'd hoped it would have. But he was lucky to live in Cavan, which was a relatively relatively peaceful place during this period. Had he lived in West Cork or somewhere more of a crucible during the revolutionary period, questionable whether he'd have escaped with himself and his property untouched.
I'm struck by something you said in your conclusion about, I can't quite remember the exact quote, but it was from one of his colleagues who seemed to suggest that in some ways he was kind of his own worst enemy, that perhaps if he was a better politician in the way he did things, he might have been more successful in terms of maybe his career and being remembered.
Yes, a candid friend, Maurice Crum, said of him that it was a streak of intolerance that had handicapped him. And that is true. He was he didn't suffer fools at all. He was a formidable personality. He had an explosive temper, partly as a result of wounds he'd received in the Boer War. And he didn't suffer fools, and he didn't suffer some people who weren't fools, like James Craig. And so, to that extent, he was his own worst enemy. But as Crum also said, his positive attributes outweighed those.
Okay, well, you bring the story of his brilliant career to life so well in the book. It's called Major General Oliver Nugent, the Irish Man Who Led the Ulster Division in the Great War. It's published in hardback by the Ulster Historical Foundation and costs £19.99, so about €22. The author is Nicholas Perry. And Nick, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book studies the Irish law dating from AD 697 called Lex Innocentium, or the Law of the Innocents. It was a law designed to offer legislative protection for women, children, clerics and other non-arms-bearing people, primarily, though not exclusively, in times of conflict. The book is called Adam Naughan's Lex Innocentium and the Jurisprudence of Warfare. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €50. The author is James Houlihan. And James, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
Tell me about this law and tell me about the role and the influence of Adam Naughan, because it's also named after him.
Adam Naughan was the ninth abbot of Iona, and he died in 704. Now, he had a very particular and singular regard for what we would call today civilians or non-combatants. He called them innocents. And he was obviously moved to do something for their plight. And there is a tradition, in fact, that Adam Naughan came across a battlefield himself Now, this is not this is more a tradition than anything that we can establish for definite. But it appears in one of the early paragraphs of his law, and which is not part of what was originally his law. It was added on at a later stage. Maybe I just, as a matter of interest, read the bit, little bit for you, which says he was with his mother at the time. Of all they saw on the battlefield, they saw nothing which they found more touching or more wretched than the head of a woman lying in one place and her body in another, and her infant on the breast of her corpse. There was a stream of milk on one of its cheeks and a stream of blood on the other cheek. So this man had this unique concern for the innocent victims of warfare. And in my research, and which was one of the what I set out to try and do, was to find, was this normal? Was this usual? Were there others who thought similarly to him? And quite frankly, I couldn't find anybody. And I'm talking now about in Western Europe, at that time, who had the same sort of concern. So that's basically it. I mean, Adam Nolan was an extremely illustrious person, hugely regarded, and by historians today. I mean, one historian actually says of him that he was one of the leading churchmen in these islands in the first millennium. So that's a fair commendation, I would imagine.
It's a fascinating law, and in a way it's almost a Hague Convention for its time. And can you explain what exactly it set out and what kinds of protections it offered?
Yes. Well, basically what it does is, the first, we'll say, paragraph of what I consider, I think is widely considered to be the actual original law as drafted by Adam Nolan, more or less, it's like a preamble to a modern statute. It says what it wants to do, and then the subsequent paragraphs go ahead and do that. So just to give you a sort of an idea, it's paragraph actually 34 of the usual translation of the law. I'll just give you an eye what it says. This is the enactment of the Corn Act of Nolan on Ireland and Britain. The freedom of God's church with her community and her insignia and her sanctuaries and all her property, living and inanimate, and her law-abiding laymen and their lawful wives who are under the authority of Adam Nolan and of a lawful wise and pious soul friend. The enactment of the Corn Adam Nolan stands as an everlasting corn for clergy and women and for innocent children until they are capable of killing a man, till they have a place in the tribe, and till their first armed conflict is known. Now, that defines what we would now really call civilians. These are non-combatant. And in my research, I couldn't find anything similar either before Adam Nolan or not really until much, much later. Normally, the Peace of God movement around the year 1000 or so is considered to be the first legislative protection in the Western world for the civilian. I call them the innocent, for the innocent. Historians of the laws of war, unfortunately, know absolutely nothing of Adam Nolan's law. Now, it goes on then to provide for whoever kills a young cleric or an innocent child. There are fines imposed then, and also in the case of a woman, anybody who kills a woman then there are very serious fines imposed for that, and then it even goes on to deal with all sorts of other offences against women, right down to putting a hand on her under her hem and that sort of thing. So it's quite comprehensive, and it provides this protection for this specific category of people. And that's what I find particularly interesting, because it is the same category of people that the Fourth Geneva Convention seeks to protect.
And do we know how significant it was at the time and what impact it had?
Well, now that's, of course, a very good question, and one that is always asked. We don't, is the answer. And we don't really for two reasons. First of all, the annals, which is one of our main sources of information, didn't really concern themselves with telling us about what happened to ordinary people. They were more concerned with telling us what happened to kings and higher clergy and all that sort of thing. So they don't actually deal with deaths and slaughters and things like that of ordinary people to any great extent. Also, unfortunately, the legal system as it operated at that time, there wasn't a record of judgments anywhere. And we just don't have any records of judgments as to how the law was, how it actually operated in practice. We know of the penalties, we know of the judges that were to judge it. These are all laid down in the law. There were special judges appointed, all of that. But actually, we don't have, in regard to this, or indeed to any other aspect of early Irish law, a particular specific case. It just doesn't exist. You know, there are no reports of cases, in other words.
Okay, well, James, congratulations on the study. It's called Out of Non's Lex Innocentium and the Jurisprudence of Warfare, published in hardback by Four Courts Press. It costs €50. The author, James Houlihan. And James, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Out of Non's Lex Innocentium and the Jurisprudence of Warfare by James W. Houlihan. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €50. And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be hearing about the life, legend and legacy of St. Bridget, and we'll be finding out how she became an important part of the Irish story. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.